In the heart of the state of the art, at the dawn of the next stage in entertainment, you found No Proscenium.
Have indeed found No Proscenium, the voice of everything immersive. I'm your host, Noah Nelson, and welcome to episode 436 of our ongoing exploration of the immersive cosmos. This week on the show, I'm talking with David Rosenberg and Glenn Neath, artistic directors of Darkfield, who are responsible for some of our favorite experiences of the past few years. They are here to talk about their latest work, Arcade, which adds an interactive twist to the Darkfield formula and which is currently touring the UK. We get into the details of the new show and their exploration of interactive narrative, and that's all coming up in a few moments. But before we do that, thanks to the incredible demand for tickets to this Sunday's LA Immersive Invitational Showcase, we've moved some things around and opened up more tickets for the 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. runs. A little over a dozen tickets are left as I'm recording this, despite the fact that we had dozens when we dropped them yesterday. This is your chance to catch all new work from Coin and Ghost, HRS Cherry Poppins, Catnip, Last Call Theater, The Queen's Fools, Rogue Artist Ensemble, The Speakeasy Society, and Spy Brunch. What's really awesome is that the new format adds two features, an intermission, and smaller audience group sizes to the event that will make it a better experience for everybody. Check the show notes for the link for tickets to the showcase this Sunday, April 21st, at the Nocturne Theater in Glendale. And all of this is put together by After Hours Theater Company in association with the Immersive Experience Institute. And coming up in May, we here at No Proscenium are hosting the world premiere of Siobhan O'Loughlin's Broken Bone Bathtub documentary, chronicling her last pre-pandemic tour of her one-woman show that took place in donated bathrooms across the United States. That one is happening at Thymele Arts in LA on Saturday, May 18th. Check the show notes for more. Finally, a quick check-in on the Patreon, which, thanks to Brian R. Seckinger and Wes, finds us just 8 backers away from the magical 450 paid backer mark, where I will stop shilling for the Patreon on the podcast for a whole month. Not only do backers get the newsletter and access to our Discord, but they also get early access and discounts to our events, such as the ones I just talked about, and the knowledge that in spite of everything wrong with the world, the cost of one grande iced latte a month is enough to keep an independent media operation from disappearing into the ether. If you're not a backer yet, head over to www.patreon.com/noproscenium and join up. And as always, big thanks to our sustaining backers, Samuel Mustry, Chris Woolman, Samantha Davison, Eric Shamlin, Elaine, Daryl, John Boulette, Cameo Wood, Tom Wilson, Jay Bushman, Jerome Joseph Gentes, Kurt Collins, Ryan, David Basick, Richard Ayers, Lonnie Hands-On, Lecker LeCool, The Ministry of Peculiarities, and Jan Budman. And hey, if you have an event that is right for our audience and you want to give them a special hookup, connect with me at noah@noproscenium.com and we will have a conversation. Returning now to the show are David Rosenberg and Glenn Neath, artistic directors of Darkfield, the masters of spatial audio narrative, to talk about their latest, Arcade, which adds a twist to the Darkfield formula in the form of a choose-your-own-adventure narrative all set inside a 1980s arcade. Glenn, David, thanks for being on the show.
Hello, thanks for having us back.
Hey, it's great to be back.
David, before we get into what sets Arcade apart from previous Darkfield shows, could you set the stage a little for those who might be hearing you on the pod for the first time?
Yeah, so, well, hi, Noah. We make shows for audiences in total darkness, usually in shipping containers, and we use binaural audio, this sort of 3D spatial audio, to create these imagined environments for audiences. and we use other sensory effects as well to augment the audio. Essentially, shipping containers, darkness, audio. That's how we do all of our shows.
Fantastic. I had the pleasure the first time of experiencing you guys' work during the height of the pandemic when you had done one for the Bram Stoker Festival, and then it managed to like get to be like on the internet in form of a broadcast. It was easily the most incredible use of spatial audio I had ever heard. And it completely freaked me out all at the same time while just being in my room. So I'm wrong. That wasn't the first time I experienced you guys' work. No, the first time I experienced you guys' work was The Invisible. And that was right before the pandemic hit.
You come down to, were you at Universal. There for the live show?
Yeah,
at Universal.
Oh, yes.
Of course. Okay.
Yeah, that would have been the first time. I don't know. It all starts to blur together. Those eras. I remember that one. Now I'm having, that one freaked me out too. Oh my God. Anyway, so it is, everyone is listening to the show. It is a little early for me today, so you're going to get the loopy Noah interviewing. So here's the thing. Arcade, this latest one. I'm going to do something cheesy. I'm going to read your guys' blurb, and you'll understand why in a second. So this is the blurb on Arcade. Arcade is the latest immersive audio experience from Darkfield, but this isn't an ordinary arcade, and these are not ordinary arcade machines. Every machine offers you the chance to enter the world of the game and choose your own unique journey. As you guide your avatar through a world ravaged by endless war, there are many routes you can take, and there are many different outcomes. Using the nostalgic 8-bit aesthetic of 1980s video games, Arcade's interactive narrative explores the evolving relationship between players and avatars. This choose-your-own-path experience will fully immerse players in alternate environments in a completely dark shipping container using 360-degree binaural sound and sensory effects. Players will be asked to address deep existential questions about free will and consciousness in a world where some may win and some may lose. Gentlemen, why did you make something so clearly for me and then put it a few several thousand miles away from me?
It's just to taunt you, Noah.
It is torture knowing that this is somewhere in the world and I can't play with it. Why the arcade metaphor? Why this aesthetic? Why this narrative at this moment?
Well, I think there's a few reasons, actually. I mean, one of the things that all of our container shows have, they've all got a sort of general effects that happen to every audience member at the same time because things are happening inside the container. With this particular show, I mean, there was lots of driving, things that we were interested in. But one of them was we were able to sort of individualize effects for each audience member, if you like. So there was in Eulogy, we had the last show previous to that, we had a little bit of an audience interaction, but any effects that we used didn't always fall in with everybody's experience, if you see what I mean, because if you're doing a slightly different narrative path, you're not going to, it's not going to fall at the same time as everybody else's. So we wanted to try and make sure that all the effects could be individual to every audience member. So we had this idea of everybody playing on an individual gaming machine, if you like, which we were able to sort of deliver effects to everybody separately.
So you come into the container, and the container is lined with 28 arcade machines. Every arcade machine has a single button and a coin slot, and that's how the players interact with the narrative, either by pressing a button or putting tokens in a coin slot, which they have to do in the dark. So that in itself is not a completely easy task. And the button is a yes button. It's like you press the button and that is you are responding on behalf of your avatar and basically saying yes. And if you don't press the button within a second, then a no answer is assumed.
Oh, wow. Well, one of the things that I love about your shipping container work is that even though as an audience member, you spend the majority of the time in darkness, when you first enter, there is a strong visual aesthetic. There's a scene you are walking into. Could you talk to me a little bit about the choices you make in setting the stage that way and in what that gives you for then taking people off in their imaginations with the sound?
Well, when we started making these shipping container shows, it became, previously the shows we'd made in theatres didn't really have sets as such. They were just in rooms with chairs. And as soon as we decided to make shows for shipping containers, we had to start thinking then about, you know, what was going to be the audience configuration or the design of those containers. And that then what we then put into those containers is the thing that people enter into and the thing that they then take into the dark with them. So it became quite clear that we needed to really, it couldn't be general. It had to be very specific, you know, so we put a real aeroplane inside flight so that people felt like they were on an aeroplane.
Because it's not just about the visual. It's not just about how things look. It's also about the materials and the textures and the materials, because all of these things are things that we then play with in the dark. So, for example, in one of our shows, Coma, people are lying in bunk beds, in these triple bunk beds that have a steel frame. And so the feel of that steel frame or the sound that it makes when you drag your hand across it, this is something that we can then play with in the dark. So it sounds like a character is approaching you and dragging their hand along the bed. So the materials are also really important.
Yeah, it's like you said about dragging the hand across the metal. It makes me think of the sound of the curtain opening in Invisible. You know, because you see the curtain and then the darkness falls, you hear the curtain open, and then, you know, the sound of someone on the stage and all the other things are happening, but that it adds this extra weight to have that physical curtain there. And it makes you think or you wonder, did they really open the curtain or was that just an audio effect? You can't help but think that we're wired that way.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're always playing with the idea of the space that the audience are in. We're playing with the idea that other audience members are interacting with the narrative in some way, which makes it feel very live for you because you may be called upon at any minute to interact with a narrative. So I think all of those little tricks, you know, and the set is one of them, helps to sort of augment this idea of not knowing whether everything is real or what's real and what isn't.
So the audience start the show in a 1980s arcade and then they enter the body of the avatar and explore this game world. But in one of the paths, your avatar could end up back in the arcade. And so the space then also is needs to be a sort of recognizable space that you could recognize through the sound in the darkness as well.
You mentioned that in the last show, you played around a little bit with giving the audience choice. Is this the first time you've really done a deep dive with audience agency in terms of the narrative?
Yeah, absolutely. Our first shows, we used to think of those as actually an antidote to choice, where we were trying to really control every part of the experiences. And even though the audience felt in some of those shows they had agency, it wasn't genuine agency. And then we made the show, as Glenn said, Eulogy, which had speech recognition. And there was a certain amount of, maybe not quite choice, but moral responsibility that the audience could take based on answers to certain questions. And then at the end of it, you got a pretty pithy and unfeeling eulogy based on some of the answers that you gave during that show. So Arcade is really all about choice. And the problem
and
with choice
as well,
is that...
It's choice in the moment, isn't it? It's like with Eulogy, there was space between the questions you may have answered at the beginning and how they played out at the end, whereas this is very direct. You're sort of answering yes or no in the moment and your avatar is responding on that very, very quickly.
Yeah, and it doesn't take long before the problems of exponential growth catch up with you.
I imagine also catches up with you guys in terms of laying out the narrative paths here. How much has this been a challenge for you guys?
Well, in most of our shows, these are shows that generally last between sort of 20 and 30 minutes or so. And with this show, there's probably over 5 hours of audio for a 20-minute experience or 25-minute experience. So it's a lot. And it's technically, it has been quite a challenge to make all of this work. We opened the show in Nottingham a couple of weeks ago or a month ago now. And things seem to be working pretty well. So we're incredibly relieved, but also sort of ready to sort of keep developing as well. So we haven't stopped yet. We're still developing the alternate pathways in the show even now.
I suppose the other thing to say actually about the creation of the stories and such like is that everybody's experience has to end at the same time. So that's been quite a challenge on top of all the other challenges about how do you make all of the possible outcomes finish at exactly the same point when the lights come on.
Yeah, that's got to be maybe the single most difficult challenge because, you know, if you think of like a choose your own adventure book or even a video game, you're often one of the major things is how long is the story is a big differentiator because the choices might unlock, you know, this choice leads you down a 3-page path and that choice leads you down a 1-page path and the end of the tale or you miss an entire, you know, level in the video game because you chose to follow the dwarf as opposed to the elf or something like that. When you guys started structuring this narrative, what did you turn to for you know, inspiration or guidance for dealing with a branching narrative like this?
Well, I mean, we couldn't. I mean, there were very few heavy narrative games that where choices really do lead you off down paths that don't converge again. I mean, it's not. Within Arcade, there were certain points where you come back together into certain environments, but you're in those environments from different perspectives, having had a different experience leading up to those environments. So it's and then from a certain point, you really you spin off on possible journeys that never converge again. We didn't really find that much, in terms of gaming, where there's lots of very sort of very open structures, which are quite different because they're much more about this sort of this free, a more free exploration, which isn't, that's not quite what we're doing because we still need to get our narratives concluded within 21 and a half minutes, like all of them. So there's a clear need to kind of have this narrative arcs that happen over these periods of time. So sort of completely free exploration doesn't quite work. Interestingly, some of the reference points were these very early text-based adventures, from the 1980s, where there was something about the game mechanics in those games, where you know, get lamp, walk north, push elf, or whatever. There's something in the quite often binary decisions of those games that had some influence, but basically we just started writing and then fitting things together and started making these massive branched maps, and it was just a long process of writing, trying to fit things in, seeing what particular, like what the meaning of particular journeys might be, reworking those. It's been a very long, long process.
And then finding cross, you know, where these paths might cross fertilize in order to suggest this a little bit the size of the world. So, you may go down one particular route, but we really were keen on the idea that you would realize that different decisions that you might have made would have given you a very different experience. So we also try to sort of suggest the size of the world as well.
It is such a fascinating challenge, right? Because it's like trying to spin six plates at once, because you've got the different settings you want to have people go through, and you also don't want to have to build an infinite number of environments, even sonically. You don't want to have to do that if for no other reason than not having some commonalities for people to walk out and talk about. Like if everyone's experience is completely different, there's no touch point, right?
Yeah.
It's making me think of it. Oh, go for it. Yeah.
Well, so I mean, the structure, which is very different to other games, is that, well, there's this 21 and a half minutes from the, and so you do whatever the journey is in that period of time and have your outcome. You could do the show 50 times and you will have a different experience. There will be some that are more closely resembled to each other than others, but still you could easily do the show that number of times and still be learning more and getting more out of it. But it's not the kind of experience that you would have, I guess, where... with games where you could start from a certain point into them and play from that point. Every time you play, you're back at the beginning trying to get to a different place.
Yeah. I mean, that structure reminds me both of the ride Star Tours, or what Star Tours has become at Disneyland, where there's like multiple different versions of the ride that are sort of randomly selected. So there's all these different combinations. They have all this different video footage they route through, but also the structure of roguelike video games where you always start in the same place, but you know, based on certain choices you make over the course of the game and also how well you're doing, the outcomes are radically different. And then you ultimately fail and then you go back and with roguelikes, you've changed a bit, so the world's going to be different next time in some ways. But it's kind of a way of recreating the sense of playing, playing a video game, playing something like Dragon's Lair or Space Ace, where it's like it's the same stuff over and over again, but you just got to kind of go back to the beginning. You can't tell, I'm like fascinated by branching structure storytelling because it's so difficult. And also it affords you some very specific things, but isn't necessarily a cure-all. And sometimes I wonder if is it worth the pain for what you get? What do you guys feel like you're getting out of this by having this structure?
Well, the thing that interaction is often at odds with narrative, or there's certainly a tension between interaction and narrative, mm-hmm. because it's hard enough to tell a single story, and when you do tell a single story, every decision that your protagonist is making in that story is important, and the fact that they didn't make all the other decisions, that's what gives you your story. So the attempting to make many different stories based on these avatar choices is incredibly difficult. But I think that one of the ways that it works is that it is all about the decisions that you're making. So there were quite a lot of storylines that actually become quite existential explorations of what it is to choose and what it is to be to be embodied, or what it is to be an avatar within a world where you think that you're in control, but maybe you're not. So some of the content actually directly addresses the form of the show. I mean, you could also just decide not to get dressed right at the beginning and do the whole show naked. So there's some there's certain things that kind of that they're just ways to play the game.
Yeah, and in our discussions, you know, we've been talking about it as we've been creating it. There's been a lot of you know. An assumption that people are going to do it more than once because it's, you know, there's really is a lot to gain from doing it numerous times. You meet characters that are referred to in other journeys, you know, the main protagonist you may not meet on some of the threads. So it's like a really, there's so many different ways you could do it. And we, I suppose there's been some joy in that, in the sort of the way that we've spoken about it. This idea that it really is fulfilling the more you do it. Whether people will do it more than once, we'll have to see.
Was that part of the motivation for chasing after this particular form, was to see if people would come back and re-engage with the world, or were you chasing something else by or was it just the challenge of trying to make a branching narrative alone or figure out agency in the context of what you guys make that caused you to build Arcade this way?
I mean, we were very interested in creating a larger and deeper world where that has been possible for us in the past. So the idea that we were able to push certain narratives much more than we were able to before, but also have these different, very different ways of engaging with narrative that you wouldn't be able to do and have all of them in a single show, but an audience member coming back and doing it a few times, then there's the sort of space in order to be able to play with both, not only just expanded narratives, but also different forms as well within those narratives.
And that's also been sort of, you know, played out when you see audiences come out. And, you know, as David said, we opened it about a month ago and we've done a couple of weeks in Nottingham and in Gloucester, and just seeing people come out and be, you know, the sort of conversations that people are having when they're sort of saying, oh, you know, did you do this? And it's like, no, you know, they're so different, the branches, that, you know, you end up in very, very different places. And that's really exciting as well, to sort of see the sort of buzz around that from audience members.
So diving inside the story in Arcade, what's the setup here? What kind of choices are people making? What kind of world are they getting to explore as part of it? Without giving away too much, but you've got the AZ's aesthetic. There's bits in here about a world ravaged by endless war. What's the narrative?
Well, the 80s aesthetic, I suppose, is more to do with the sort of the external the framing of it. You know, the arcade machines and that doesn't really necessarily carry on into the world, I would necessarily say, but the sort of story is set in this world ravaged by war. There are two sides. You know, you're invited numerous times to join one or the other. There are sort of a couple of main leaders of each side that you can either have relationships with or not. As I said, in some threads, you might not even meet one of them. And then I think, and David started talking a bit about this idea of choice, and I think there's been a lot of this idea around the idea of the relationship that the player is having with their avatar, and how the avatar maybe starts to become a little bit sentient and to start to think about, you know, the choices that they're making and what ownership they have of those choices.
Mm. Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Bit.
And also, I think that quite a lot of it is. It's sort of about moral luck. It's like, you know, we think that we own the decisions we make, and we think we are making these free decisions all the time. But so much of what we're doing, I mean, some would argue all of what we're doing, is just we are all just victims to all of the things that happened prior to the point where we made a decision. Yeah. And the fact that we did something at a certain time, we joined one side rather than another side, or we decided to shoot one person or kiss another person. These things that you could play the game a few different times and you will find yourself in a position where one decision seems obvious and another time where a completely different decision seems like the obvious choice. So these are also the underlying feelings that we hope that the players get.
I like that idea that you're addressing, sort of interrogating the structure of choice, the structure of decision making in terms of context, by deploying this kind of structure, right? Like it's that makes it feel very essential to what you're doing, as opposed to just like, oh, we've got a toy to play with. It's like, no, but what does it really mean to have choice, or do we have choice? That's exciting stuff. I shouldn't be surprised that you guys are thinking deeply about things like that, and wouldn't just be, you know, trying something so complex just for funsies alone. There's something driving at you guys.
There's something quite exciting about the characters in the show being surprised at some of the decisions they make, I suppose. You know, so they may cause something bad to happen, which they maybe would argue that they weren't thinking. So it's playing with this idea about, you know, what agency do they have, you know, when there's somebody answering the questions that are being asked of them.
Yeah. That reminds me of, like, there was a mode, the Mass Effect games, which, you know, for those who don't know, is a science fiction series by BioWare, who are long sort of masters of a certain kind of role-playing game. And that series is a little bit controversial, is not the right word, but some gamers didn't love the fact that when you were given options in dialogue scenes, you weren't given your dialogue. You were given sort of the subtext of the dialogue, and then you chose that, and then things played out, the script played out. I loved it because it felt more like an acting exercise, or even a directing exercise. I was choosing the emotional reaction, and then the character, you know, went forward and did things. Some players hated the fact that they didn't have minute control over what was being said. But as I played that game, and there was a mode where you could play it with your voice, so you would just speak the subtext. So it felt like I was side coaching an actor through a devised scene. Like, I absolutely loved it. It was just pure candy for me. It started to felt like I had this relationship to the character as opposed to being the character entirely, but in a way it was like a deeper relationship. I feel more like that character was a co-creation of mine than maybe any other role-playing game character in a video game I've ever gotten to play, because of this uncertainty as to how Shepard was going to react if I said, well, you're angry now. You know, like, and the angry might be like, you might say like, that tears it. And you knew that was going to be an extreme reaction, because there was like color coding that basically made it clear, like, oh, they're going to shoot someone now. But you say it and then they do it, or they overreact. You're like, whoa, 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 I didn't mean that. And it gave this kind of uncanny sense that the character had their own agency. And they never went to a place where, like, the character and you never had a conversation, but that, you know, and that wasn't what those games were about. But I could feel that mechanic affording the same kind of thing, where at a certain point, the character turned to you like, what are you doing to me, man? Why do you keep making me make these choices?
No, I think that is a thing that we're playing with quite a lot. And I think that another kind of fun thing is this, the having to you make a decision for your avatar, and then your avatar, based on your decision, kind of then has to confabulate, like, why they made that decision, because somehow they don't quite know. I mean, this could happen in as simply as you're in the job center and the person behind the desks asks whether you've had a job before. Now, you probably haven't had a job before, or certainly not one that you anyone knows about. But if you, as the player, answer yes to that, then you have to listen to your avatar kind of squirming and trying to come up with some kind of answer as to what the job was. So and there's quite a lot of playful moments where you sort of get that you put the avatar in some kind of shit that they have to get out of.
Yeah, that's great. That sounds like an out of control improv show where the audience is torturing the actors. So something that maybe I've been on both sides of the line on in my day. This one sounds lovely. It's been in Gloucester and in Nottingham, or maybe Nottingham and Gloucester. I may have reversed order. What's the destiny for Arcade? Is this a touring setup that you've got going on here?
Yeah, I suppose the same with all our shows. We try and get them out as much as we can. I mean, most of our previous shows we've premiered in Edinburgh. This one, we've had a few goes at it before we get to Edinburgh, which is, I think, is a good idea because, you know, there's quite a lot of stake when you land there. So we'll have had a few outings. As David says, we're continuing to work on it. So by the time we get to Edinburgh, we will hopefully be, it's kind of working now, as David says, but it's this little bits we're adding, little levels we're opening up, some rewrites, some re-records. So by Edinburgh, hopefully we managed to get all that done. Then beyond there, you know, who knows? I mean, we'd like to obviously do it elsewhere, as we're doing with all our containers.
Yeah, I mean, it will tour internationally at some point. We've already had quite a bit of interest with some foreign language versions of it, which we're terrified of, given the amount of work that no doubt that will create. But yeah, it will come to the States at some point.
I mean, that wasn't the subtext, but yes, also was the subtext. So yay! Yeah.
There'll be a shipping container landing just outside your house now.
I mean, the cunningest one there right now, so you might as well move in. in the construction, bring in you guys. How have things been? You know, the first time we talked was in 2021. Wow. I want a time machine. That would have been fun. It was in 2021, height of the pandemic, or I guess maybe just things starting to like unpandemic themselves a little. You've had such an explosion of work. There's been Darkfield Radio. There's been all this festival work. You're back in containers again. How do you feel things have developed or changed for Darkfield as an entity over the past few years?
Well, that over the pandemic, we were making a lot of digital work during that time, and far more work than we had made prior to the pandemic, where because there was always this structure, this set that we had to build, that we couldn't kind of knock them out quite so quickly. But during the pandemic, we worked. We just worked incredibly hard, and we made a lot of different digital shows, and that gave us quite a lot of international reach. That then led to physical shows going to certain places around the world. So I think that things have developed for us now that we have quite a few good international partners who are always sort of keen to take on the new shows. And yeah, so I'm hoping, I mean, America is still a place where we've had a couple of false starts at touring work there, but we're quite confident that this year is going to be the one where it's going to work out. Let's see.
Oh, no, even Americans have false starts with making work in America. So like you're par for the course, unfortunately. I don't know why it's so difficult to make things here, but it is. It drives me crazy.
Yeah. It's very expensive to make work there, to build things.
That's been the footprint in terms of internally with the team or with your process. Like, how do you feel you've evolved by making all that digital work? That's one question. I've got another question about sort of post-pandemic, but yeah, how do you feel the team's evolved and what you're doing is evolving internally?
I think it's certainly opened out our audience, and maybe that's had some effect on the way we think about ourselves. Maybe, I mean, we always thought of ourselves as a sort of theatre company, but we came from theatrical backgrounds. But the sort of pandemic and all the sort of inclusion in all these film festivals and such like sort of opened up this new audience who were very, you know, welcoming. So we got to be involved in all these film festivals with audio work. You know, it was kind of it was a whole new audience, and I think that's sort of maybe that's made us think about ourselves slightly differently.
I mean, it's certainly made us think a lot more about how to push our work from a technological perspective. So we had this, this show of speech recognition. We this current arcade show is very tech heavy and it's and complex. And we also have a couple of other projects in the pipeline that we're planning on, which use real-time spatialization of audio and a mobile audience. And there's a few other projects that pushing the what is possible with tech has become more of an important component of the work.
And have you seen the audience evolve? Because I think for some people, the first time they've experienced something in binaural audio, you know, back in the day might have been one of your shows. Now, spatial audio and the idea of spatial audio is—it's not quite commodified, but it's definitely a lot more commercialized. At least on the music side, Apple pushes it inside the their music app, and you find the audience like a little more savvy, a little less wowed by just the simple facts,
for sure. When we made our first show, Ring, our first show for audiences in the dark, when was that, Glenn?
That was 2012.
So with that show, that was for most of the audience. This was the first time that they had heard binaural audio recordings. And still today, people will reference that show and just there's still some lingering effect that it's had on people because it is so strong to hear this kind of sound for the first time. And now, I mean, you're right. The people have heard. I mean, people have done a lot of ASMR stuff, and in fact, that's probably the most common. Like if people don't like a show, then they're like, yeah, you know, that was what 20 minutes of like weird ASMR. That would be like a standard kind of cuss. That's something that no one would have known what that was when we started. I mean, it wasn't in any way a popular thing. So I think now it's certainly not enough to just kind of whisper in people's ears anymore. Like there's lots of other ways that we need to keep on pushing this, both the technology and the way that we're doing the recordings and the narratives that we're telling, in order to keep things compelling.
The other thing that's kind of that feels very different in terms of audience responses is that, you know, when we started making shows, Twitter was, from my memory, quite new or something. So that seemed to be where everybody was talking about this sort of stuff, but it was spoken about in a very different way to the way that people speak about experiencing shows now. I mean, when you sort of look at the stuff that people are putting on TikTok about our work, it's almost like we're some sort of commercial entity, which we never imagined ourselves previously. But you know, the way that they go, we're off to see the Darkfield shows and stuff, and it's because it's a very different way that they're engaging with the work than previously. You know, and the way that people review shows, they sort of, you get audience reviews. Previously, it was all about which newspaper was going to come and see you. You know, it's all changed quite quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, that side of the business. I mean, I still don't. I have a grand resistance to, like, grokking TikTok. One, because I don't want to do a bunch of selfie videos, just number one. And then number two, if I were to do them, I would want there to be some level of production quality, and that just sounds like a lot of work. There is this grand change in terms of how people discover everything or or where the conversation happens, and it's so fractured, now more so than ever, which, you know, as someone who like runs around trying to like help people find audiences, it kind of drives me up the wall. Probably means that ultimately I have to give in and start making selfie videos. Oh God.
It's like they sort of feel that they have ownership of it in a kind of slightly different way. You know, the way that they sort of, it becomes as you said, it's like a production of their own. It's like the way that they talk about engaging with work is very different, I think.
Yeah. There's a real performative aspect. I mean, that's like the most pedestrian observation about TikTok ever. I mean, the slide in social media feels like the shift from people living their lives to performing their lives. And, you know, that was true from like, you know, MySpace to do a bit of a Wayback Machine. Like that's when the bug started happening. And now it's almost fully disambiguated. Like, the performance of your life is your life. And, you know, as someone who's a lot older than the current generation by like two generations now, that feels so antithetical to like what the point of being a teenager or a college student was like when I was coming up. Like the watchwords were authenticity and being genuine. And now the watchwords are quote authenticity and quote being genuine, right? You know, that distinction, that, you know, like the idea, centering around like the idea of selling out, right? Like, you know, selling out was a bad thing. Now for a long time, you know, selling out was what you wanted. I don't know where it's going. I don't know if we're locked into that or not. This is giving me a whole different apologies.
Well, yeah. but also I think that, I mean, this is something that has been going on for a very long time. Like even when we were growing up, we would see the films and read the books and decide that and learn what love is, and so we reproduce that love that we saw, and wear the outfits and copy the media and the media copied us. It's like the Baudrillard simulation in Simulacra, or the other way around, whatever it is. It's just the like culture has been copying itself and copying itself and copies of copies of copies, and we've just been going along with it for at least since I was a kid. And probably before, maybe 100 years ago. I don't know. Probably a long time ago.
Yeah.
Maybe 1,000.
Yeah. I mean, that's the function, right? Like, you know, like it replicates, but then mutates and goes on. It's, I guess the funky thing about being, you know, and part of the cohort that we are, getting to see so much change happen over the course of 20, 30 years, like just how radically different, but I suppose from the space age to the internet age was equally mind blowing. So anyway, digression. Ooh, what a shock it comes with me. Gentlemen, I know you've got to get rock and rolling, but you mentioned Edinburgh as being the sort of the crux point here for Arcade. Any other stops on the way until Fringe Fest this year?
Yeah, we're going to Norwich in June, I think, and Bradford probably in July.
All right. Well, keep an ear out, everyone, and then hopefully after Edinburgh, the international plans will fall into place, and a shipping container will be parked outside of my door. So, Glenn, David, it's been a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you guys again, and wishing you much success with Arcade, and as always, looking forward to whatever Darkfield is cooking up next.
Thank you, Noah.
Thanks, Noah.
Once again, I want to thank David and Glenn for being our guests on the show this week. Do check the show notes for how to see Arcade and to connect in with Darkfield as an entity. Truly just one of the best groups of creators working out there in the world today when it comes to making immersive magic. Speaking of people making immersive magic, of course, I gave you the pitch at the beginning, but I'm very excited that we are doing the Immersive Invitational this weekend over there at the Nocturne Theater in Glendale. I hope to see a lot of you from the LA area there this weekend. Maybe you're even taking your headphones off right as you're walking up to the door, and there I am, and you're like, wow, how did he do that? And the truth is, you did that, not me. So there's that going on. And then of course, looking forward to seeing everybody, when we do the, screening of Siobhan's movie and the meetup at Thymele, in May. I am calling an audible right now on next week's episode and saying that there probably won't be one. There's material in the can already, and some other stuff that's been recorded. But I had a curveball thrown at me earlier today. I'm recording this on April 18th. And that curveball involves some family medical stuff. And I need to just clear some space for next week to make sure that I can get a few ducks done in a row and make sure that I can be around for recovery for my mom post some surgery that's going to happen. It's not, or that's supposed to happen. It is allegedly going to be happening at the top of next week. And I just want to make sure that I am there for that and that I'm not compressed, doing other things. And then when time comes, I can actually, pay true attention to the podcast. So an unexpected break, and it's not like I'm off and partying, but I wanted to just, call that audible right now. Make your nose. I feel a lot of guilt when I drop an episode. And yes, there's plenty of stuff going on in the news right now on the immersive side of things. And but check the newsletter for links to some of that stuff, because that's where I'm putting that energy right now. My brain is mostly full with the American medical system. So I'll just put it that way. All right. That's it for now. And that's more than I'm comfortable talking about usually. So let's get out of here. The associate producer of this podcast is Parker Sella. Music for No Proscenium is by Chris Porter of the Speakeasy Society and Solar the Podcast, who I get to see this weekend. Special thanks to Siobhan O'Loughlin for voicing our intro. I get to see Siobhan this weekend. And this podcast is written, edited, hosted, produced, yada, 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 by me. I'm Noah Nelson. And until next time, I'll see you at the show.